Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies. Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies, and we're sitting here with the gentleman who's been called a disruptor.
What?
When I think of you, I think this guy's a disruptor. Look at that face.
We've met him, though, on a number of occasions, social occasions and business occasions. He seems like a perfectly nice guy.
I've never disrupted a dinner yet.
This is Ted Sarandos, the chief content officer of Netflix. You've heard of them. And the whole world has heard of you now. I mean, my gosh. What an incredible saga this is. And ongoing saga, of course. Every day seems like a new day. Does it seem that way to you, or does it seem like you've come to a plateau, and then you're reaching for the next plateau?
So I have been around here, believe it or not. People don't understand that Netflix has been around for a long time. So yeah. I've been almost 20 years at Netflix. Mm. And I don't think any 2 years of the job have been the same. Mm-hmm. So from the kind of scrappy startup mailing DVDs around only in the U.S. to where we're at today, which is we operate everywhere in the world except China, North Korea, and Syria.
Not going to say a word.
Yeah, these are travel spots you should be looking for. We produce, as you know, an enormous amount of original films and television, not just in the U.S., but we have 130 seasons of local language television that we're in production of around the world. And major feature films, and it's moved from being what it was just this scrappy DVD by mail startup to a major global media company.
You say scrappy, but people lived for it.
I mean scrappy in that I used to office in my bedroom.
And... Yes, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, that was a thing that people talk about Blockbuster and how much they miss that. But when I was younger, it was also Netflix, and people had their queues. That's how the word queue came into America.
Yeah, we brought
queue
with us.
By the way, in the UK, they love that. Here, I'd never heard it used, and then suddenly people were saying, oh, it's in my Netflix queue. Your what? My Netflix queue.
I remember it got so popular, the DVD by mail service, that you'd go to certain post offices, and there'd be a separate box just for Netflix envelopes.
How funny.
So, yeah.
Man. Yeah.
So you've already changed the culture, so to speak, more than once. A direct impact. Talk about cause and effect. Those red envelopes, you know.
That was a thing.
That was a thing.
Every once in a while, they show up in a movie. Every once in a while, you see the show. Yeah.
We have an ad. Someone did, when my dad was on Reels channel, they did as a photo ad, him holding a ton of those envelopes.
Oh, yeah.
I have it framed in my room. It's a funny shot. Yeah. Just tons of those Netflix envelopes. One's in your mouth.
So they had to explain to people, what is those? Yeah. What are those things?
What are they holding?
That's a
DVD.
We were talking before we started about speaking out at Chapman University this week, and I always remind, I start telling my life story, and my into this was working in a video store. And I realized most of the audience has no idea what a video store is.
Yeah.
And I said, that's like being a blacksmith. It's one of those jobs that just don't exist
that's
anymore.
That's right, buggy whip manufacturer.
Exactly.
Let's ask you to do essentially what you've done many times
before.
Tell us
about Little Ted.
Little Ted.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. Mm-hmm. Born in New Jersey, but my family moved to Phoenix when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty uneventful childhood, except my parents were very young folks and who had started having babies way too young. And so we had five. I'm one of five. And my house was like so chaotic all the time with these young parents and all these kids running around. My parents had four kids in their, while they were in their 20s.
Wow.
So it was like a pretty unstructured living at the Sarandos house, except for television. And I used to take a lot of comfort from the structure of television, from the schedule, from what was going on. Those seemingly peaceful lives that were happening in that box looked pretty appealing to me. So my early, you know, my earliest connection to entertainment really was, for me, it was a real escape. It was a real, you know, place to get away from.
Sounds
the
like
chaos
a safe haven, also.
Yeah. And I wasn't a big sleeper, so I didn't need a lot of sleep back then. I would sleep for 4 or 5 hours a night, so I would stay up late. And I late night television in Phoenix, Arizona, was mostly what you'd expect. I Love Lucy, the Dick Van Dyke Show, the Andy Griffith Show, the Jack Benny program. And as it got later, you might get into the FBI and you might get into Dragnet episodes. But so they, people experienced me kind of as an old soul because I was aware of things 20 and 30 years ahead of my time. But, and it's interesting now because young people don't know TV from the 70s and 80s the way that I knew TV in the 50s when I was growing up.
Yeah, there is a kind of a, again, that word culture, this kind of a pop culture disconnect.
Yeah.
Every 4 or 5 years, it seems now.
Yeah.
You know, things get cycled through.
And probably like the bias to, there's so much new now that there's even a stronger bias to new.
But
than
it's
ever.
Also just interesting as to what plays in different places.
Oh, yeah.
In the UK, they still show Ricky Lake episodes from the 90s. The funniest thing, I turned it on and it was a couple was arguing over who got to keep the VCR. And she was doing one of those like court things where Ricky decides. And I thought, this is the most wonderfully dated thing where most people would go, what are they fighting
they
over?
They have to capture it now.
It's a VCR. It's a VCR. Same way, I grew up where I Love Lucy was on television from 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock.
Yep.
And then it was The Simpsons for an hour. So I watched I Love Lucy every single day.
Right.
My husband, who's from England, they never showed it. So he knows who she is, kind of.
Kind of.
Like he sees her, and she's on so much stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they put her on mugs and what have you, so he can sort of identify. But it's like another world.
Yeah, and it's an interesting, I mean, one of the interesting evolutions of Netflix, I'll go back to the Ted childhood whenever you're ready.
Yeah.
But I think that one of the interesting evolutions of this is when we do an original show on Netflix, we make it available to the world in the same moment in 190 countries. And what happens overnight, you know, someone like Millie Bobby Brown on Stranger Things, overnight her social media fills up from in every language.
Yeah.
And overnight millions of followers that, you know, become, which from all over the world. So it wasn't this whole thing that you had to go to another country and explain to anybody who Millie Bobby Brown is. She's a global star.
Yeah.
And that happened within 24 hours of the launch of that show. Wow. And it happens every week on Netflix. It's pretty incredible.
It's wild.
So continue your saga.
Yeah, so
you're a TV junkie.
I was a TV junkie, and I for some reason, at a very young age, I thought I would be a journalist. And I really admired journalists, and mostly what I knew about them is what I've learned from watching Lou Grant and others.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But I thought for sure that was going to be my course in life. I was going to community college in Phoenix and at Glendale Community College and working at a video store, which happened to open in my neighborhood. It was almost like a meant-to-be thing. It was the second store in the video store in the state, and it opened in my neighborhood. And my upbringing makes no sense. My parents, we didn't have a lot of money, but my mom, probably in her own kind of reckless way, always had whatever the latest entertainment thing was. So we had a VCR, and I didn't know anyone else who had a VCR. We had, early on, we had a little HBO dish that you used to be able to buy at Radio Shack, and you'd get HBO. And you get a little paper HBO guide in the mail, and we had that. We didn't always have electricity. We didn't always have gas, or the phone was often disconnected, but we always had all these things. So it was cool that I had a VCR and a video store open in my neighborhood. And I went into the store, met a guy, his name is Dale Mason, still operates one store in Phoenix, Arizona. He and I started talking about his story. He grew up in Chicago, was an air traffic controller at O'Hare Airport, which was a super high stress job, and he hated it. And he had read in a magazine somewhere that the big businesses of the 80s would be video stores and yogurt shops. And he said, I hate yogurt and I love movies. So he cashed out all of his money that he could, and he moved to Phoenix, Arizona, and opened a video store. And it was just like, and so we, and I used to go in the store all the time and just hang out and talk to him and move the boxes around on the shelf and organize them for him. And so I just was a hanging around guy. And he finally said, "Do you want a job?" And I, so I took a job working there. And I had my second year of community college, this epiphany that I wasn't a very good writer.
Whoops.
Yeah. And I don't, and I guess I worked hard enough that I was certainly, you know, I was serviceable, you know, and no one ever told me you're not a very good writer. You should think about a different career path. but I so enjoyed this, the interview, mm-hmm. much, really enjoyed the research, but then I'd sit down to write and it was very difficult and I didn't have the passion for it because I didn't, and now I realize it's probably because I knew it wasn't very good. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and I went to the, and I was at the time thinking about going to Northern Arizona University. I was the editor of the college newspaper, so mm-hmm. I got an award for layout and design, and they came with a scholarship opportunity, and I just realized I wasn't going to be a journalist, and I didn't know what else to do. And Dale, the owner of the store, said, "Well, I would hope you would take a year and take over things for me, because now the store had expanded to 9 stores, and this guy was spending no time at home, and his wife was mad at him all the time. So he said, you know, why don't you give me some time to go off, and you could take over everything." And he just kind of gave me the keys to this entire chain of stores. Hmm. And it turned out to be an MBA course and a film school all wrapped up in one.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was able to run the store from top to bottom, hire, fire the people, programming, marketing, janitorial, negotiate leases, things I knew nothing about, by the way.
How old were you?
18, 19.
Wow.
20 years old, maybe.
That's
18,
a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. And it, now it feels kind of low stakes, so it's okay. Yeah. But it was a great way to learn a lot. And then the great thing was video stores were empty all day.
Yeah.
So it's all you could do. I watched everything in the store.
Hmm.
And over time, I, of course, we did what young people do. I hired all my buddies to work in all the other
right.
stores. And we would call each other and say, "Hey, what do you, let's watch this." And then we'd get together after the stores closed and talk about those movies. And so it was like I said, it was like a build your own film school and definitely an MBA course learning. And also the you said about things, how what things work in different places,
yeah.
different countries.
Yeah.
What I found is how things played in different neighborhoods.
Sure.
And
of course.
It was always a source of fascination for me.
Well, Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, who are old buddies of mine, told me that you knew Rudy Ray Moore and Dolomite from being a video store guy.
I did. They came in from when they came in to pitch Dolomite. Eddie came in too, which I was so pretty. I mean, unbelievably excited. There's no bigger superstar, right? And he came in to do it. And I think they had fully planned on spending 30 of the 40-minute pitch explaining who Rudy Ray Moore was.
Of course.
But I totally knew Rudy Ray Moore. Wow. Every store we had the copy of Dolomite. And he, so instead of pitching out who he was, Eddie just performed the material.
Mm-hmm.
And which, forgetting the fact that it was this crazy, indulgent thing to have Eddie Murphy perform for you directly. But also, it's just there was a lightning bolt that we have to make that movie.
Sure.
So,
well, that's the best compliment I can give you is that as long as we've known you and gotten to speak to you, you love movies.
I love movies.
And it's the nicest thing in the world to be able to tell people that when they're talking about Netflix, that I know that someone who is at the top of this company genuinely loves movies.
Yeah.
Because it's what matters.
And now, you know? And I also, like, the motivation for all this is I was like the one nice thing about being a journalism major was I had access to out-of-town newspapers all the time.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
So even though I lived in Phoenix, Jim Jarmusch, Spike Lee, these guys didn't exist in Phoenix.
Not big in Phoenix?
No, not
Spike
forget
Lee
about
didn't
not
have
big.
A big no, I know.
Not existent.
I'm just teasing.
Like, there was
yeah.
one art house theater,
yeah.
and it was out at Arizona State University. It was mm-hmm. in Tempe. So for me to get to see a movie that was out of the mainstream at all, I got on a bus for an hour to go across town. And I remember my buddy and I got doing that for one night to go two nights in a row to see Showa. and got there just in time both nights. So we're sitting in the front row for 4.5 hours watching this foreign language subtitled and dubbed documentary about the Holocaust. But that's like, those were the experiences. And I realized when the video store opened was all of a sudden there's all those people I've been reading about in the newspaper. There's those movies I've been reading about that otherwise didn't really even exist in Arizona. So that part of the motivation for Netflix was this kind of cool democratization of storytelling and movies that are a little out of the mainstream.
Yeah.
So I'm a real soft spot for indies and docs and foreign language film because I was starved of it as a kid.
Sure.
People, the first thing people say to my dad all the time is, so what do you think of streaming? And like that.
Yeah.
With this sort of an attitude of, you know, so what do you, and every single time we say the same thing. It gives people an opportunity. It gives people a place. Yeah. And if you're a filmmaker, what you care about at the end of the day is people seeing your movie.
Yeah.
So yes, of course, everyone I think dreams of the premiere like in the movies with the flashing lights and everything else. But the reality is when that's over, was it just that audience that saw your film?
Right.
And we meet filmmakers all the time who say, I'm so grateful that I was with Netflix, or I'm so grateful that my movie is seen, like you're talking about, globally.
And it might be that it's generational and cultural, like the idea of a movie, you know, the idea that you grew up with in your head was in a big dark room with strangers.
Oh, yeah.
And then I'm not saying the more you get away from that as you age up or as you go through life, but as people have, for a long time, people have seen most of their movies at home. You know what I mean?
Really, statistically, that's been true for a long time.
And it doesn't take anything away from this incredible.
I
love the experience of sitting in a theater and watching a movie with strangers.
Yeah.
I to be lost in the experience. And one of the great things I get to do with our own films is, you know, go out on the festival circuit with them and do these, go to screening. I've seen Irishman in a theater 13, 14 times now.
Jesus.
And I never, it's never lost on me what a great experience that is. I saw Roma in probably 20 theaters around the world for screenings, always thinking as soon as we do the introduction, I'd slip out and go to dinner, and always slipping into the seat and watching it again. And I would say, like in the case of Roma, it was a very different and better experience seeing in the theater. Now, most people didn't have the luxury of doing that, but it was because of the sound design and because of, you know, the general kind of pacing of that film, it was a really great experience in the theater. It's also great at home, but it was better in the theater for sure. But most films are not really, and I could have had many experiences where I'd say, well, I'm glad I saw that in a theater, but more and more I'm like, I'm glad I saw that. You know,
yeah exactly. Now people would debate you on that, of course.
But
I know that...
Well, there's no debate that seeing the Mona Lisa at the Louvre is spectacular.
Yes.
But thank God I could also Google it.
Exactly.
It doesn't have to be an either or. It doesn't have to be a conversation where it's like, it's this or that.
Right.
And because you're a movie buff, you would never say to someone, oh no, who wants to see a movie in a theater?
No.
You'd never, but that's what I mean. I think people have an attitude.
Right.
And you sort of go, you don't have to have that attitude.
Yeah.
We can love all of it.
We saw, my wife and I were lucky to see The Irishman opening day at the Egyptian Theater.
Oh, great.
And oh, great is right.
Yeah.
The film and the experience, both. And but I look forward to seeing it again at home where, you know, I'll make myself comfortable for a long sit.
Yeah.
And we'll try not to get up. We'll try to just focus on that.
You know,
but these things keep, as you say, they keep changing and evolving. Just a short sidetrack. When I was in junior high school, also a TV junkie, but getting to be a real old movie buff, I would sometimes force myself to go to sleep early, set the alarm for 2:15 in the morning, to wake up to see Howard Hawks' 20th Century with John Barrymore and Carol Lombard.
Because it was playing in the middle of the night.
Because it was playing in the middle of the night, and there was no other way to see it.
Yeah, wow.
And I lived just outside of New York, which had revival theaters, but that one never seemed to turn up. So I did that and then tried to force myself to go back to sleep.
Yeah.
So I'd be awake at school in the morning. I mean, you know, that was effort. Was real effort.
And think about this. Not that much earlier than that, that movie just didn't exist in the culture anymore.
Mm-hmm. Precisely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, before TV came along.
And TV became the elephant burial ground of so many movies.
Yeah.
But then became a treasure trove of movies.
Right.
In the years before, there was a Turner Classic Movies channel, and long before the internet, long before Netflix, that was the choice you had.
And it's interesting. It took television to bring that movie to your house in the middle of the night, and then it took cable television to have channels that would be niche enough that they could put all kinds of great movies on TV again. And then it took the internet to take it to the next step, which is to put it all at your fingertips.
Yes.
You know, anytime you want.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's just extraordinary. The part I don't get is when and how did you and Reed Hastings, the founder of Netflix.
The important step of that story is Reed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when and how did you figure out you ought to be a network? You ought to be like, you know, like a source.
This is
not just a conveyance, but a source.
Yeah. I would I met Reed. So I'm running these video stores for a long time. I just fell in love with it. I stuck with it for a long time. Then I went to work from there to a the home video distributors that sold the videos to the stores.
Mm-hmm.
And then for a very short window, I took a job running a retail chain, West Coast Video and Video City. They were kind of a Hollywood video size or style chain of stores. And they were based in California, so I moved from Phoenix to LA. And it was a very shortly thereafter I met Reed. And I met Reed because while I was in this short stint there, I did what was the first of its kind, a revenue share deal on DVD for this chain of stores. And we got excited. The reason why I was kind of early in DVD was our stores happened to be in these kind of middle-sized markets. Most of them had a military base near them. And people in the military tend to be young men, gadget-centric, disposable income.
Yeah.
So they were early adopters of DVD. So our stores had high demand on DVD early.
Huh.
So and the problem was if you were stuck in these VHS revenue share deals, they wouldn't allow you to put the DVDs of the same movies on the shelf even. So it was a bunch of complexity. But we weren't in any of those deals, so we were able to do it. So I did a deal with Warner Brothers and Sony to do DVD revenue sharing and DVD sell-through and all those things early. And Reed saw it in a trade magazine and said, I need to talk to that guy. Because Netflix was up and running. He had raised a bunch of money privately, and they were burning through it like crazy because as we grew, they needed more DVDs all the time.
Yeah.
So the revenue sharing enabled us to get enough inventory to have a good customer experience as we grew, and then we just kind of paid as you went instead of sucking up all the cash. So it was I get a mutual friend, actually someone I used to sell to from the distributors. I was this guy named Mitch Lowe, who I also kind of went off and did Redbox later.
Mm-hmm.
But he introduced me and Reed and I. And I had I did my very first e-commerce transaction, which was to buy that Southwest airline ticket to go meet him in San Jose. And we had an amazing conversation in late, I believe, October of 1999, when Reed said what seems like a very audacious thing right now was that all filmed entertainment is going to come into the home on the internet. So to think about that, it means that, you know, in 1999, when the internet was super slow and super expensive, that Reed said that cable TV is not going to exist someday, you know, and this is 1999. And I thought, to be honest with you, I thought it was a kind of a kooky thing to think or say. But he said it with such clarity and such, he was so certain of it. And I said, well, the internet's super slow. Someone emailed me a clip from South Park. It took 7 days to open it. Are you sure? And he's like, no. Moore's Law is coming. Internet's going to get twice as fast at half the price every 18 months. And it happened just like he said in 1999.
Is he a witch?
well, he floats.
Yes, he's a witch.
But I would tell you that I remember the sense of visionary that, you know, that you walked away from that meeting. And he offered me a job to come work at Netflix and help with the securing relationships with the studios and programming. And I said, you know, I don't know if this is gonna work. What he's talking about, but this guy's going to change the world, and I want to be around it. And I said yes, and I joined Netflix.
Foresighted of him and foresighted of you.
As it turns out, yeah.
No, it's more than just turns out. I have one small, go ahead.
No, just that you asked about the network part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So back in that whole thing where this is going to move from physical media, you know, he didn't call the company DVD Flix because he always thought the DVD was just the temporary way to move bits.
Mm-hmm.
The internet was going to get cheaper and we'd move bits through the internet. But in the meantime, put them on a disc and mail them. So that, and during that, what he saw as the big prize then was not original programming or even programming at all. It was the marketing aspect of it that at the time that he and I were talking in 99, the big debate was digital theaters and who was going to pay to put the digital projectors into the theaters, the studios or the theaters. And we had this great conversation where the outcome was, well, if this was going to be such a great thing for everybody, no one would be fighting about who's going to pay for it. The cheapest thing the studio does is mail prints around.
Yeah.
Right? So this doesn't change the P&L. The marketing changes the P&L. If you can help people find things that they're going to love in a more efficient way, you can change the P&L of an entertainment company. And the idea of personalized merchandising through algorithm and figuring out what people like and showing them that. And I had a real world example of it was in back when I was doing those stores and I was telling you neighborhood to neighborhood, it was hard to figure out what people would see. Some stores did really great with art films and some didn't do them at all. But I realized as a fan that if I go to see a German language film at the Valley Art Theater, and 3 months later another good German art language film comes out and is playing there, the studio has to blanket the whole city to find me, because they'd have no idea whether that I love that movie. But if they knew where I lived, and they knew that I was a great target for this thing, yeah, that was game changing. So the whole thing really was started to figure out, can you make a better experience than a video store or a shopping experience if it's personalized just for your taste all the time, and wouldn't have this need for the marketing, which actually cost more than the movie sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, now this data gathering has been smeared and gotten a bad name, and sometimes for very good cause.
Yeah, definitely.
And I remember back in the video days, a film professor writing to me complaining that he'd been renting John Ford movies from his local store, but they saw it as him renting John Wayne movies. And John Wayne, no secret to say, John Wayne leaned to the right, politically speaking.
I thought you meant physically.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, true. It's true. Yeah.
Well, that loping walk of his,
to the right.
But he was renting John Ford movies.
Right.
Not for political reasons at all.
Right.
And yet he was getting on a mailing list because they had targeted him.
Huh.
Oh, at a video store gave him that.
Yes.
Wow,
uh-huh.
Wow.
So that was pretty early on.
That's really
it was the first time I encountered that issue. Now, of course, the barns burned down, the cows are long gone.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anybody any privacy.
Like for us, though, I think why we steer clear of all those things is we don't collect any demographic data.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how old or young or male or female or otherwise any of our members are.
I just see what you like.
That's what matters, what you like.
Yeah.
And also we don't sell advertising, so there's no reason to do any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the data is anonymized. So basically it's, they're profiles of people, they're not people. And the thing that you watch is not very telling for other things. Right, the most important thing, if you're open to, if you like a Woody Allen movie, you probably like an Albert Brooks movie.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's really important. That's super important.
Right.
Yeah.
But how you vote or what you buy or what you drink or what car you drive means nothing to that.
Yeah. Well, so you have no horse in that race. So
no, we do not.
That's important.
We do not, yeah.
Important to know.
Yeah.
It is fun. I have to say for that, it is always funny because before you would have multiple profiles, before it got as detailed as it is now, you'd always know if someone else had watched. My husband, because suddenly all these sci-fi things are popping up and I'm like, why are those? My mom's watching it, a bunch of British dramas are popping up. It's like, but if you want to stalk your family and friends, that's the way.
Yeah. In the early,
my Netflix. I know you did.
In the earlier versions of these, merchandising algorithms, they were kind of clunky.
Yeah.
So they would do things like if you watched a bunch of John Wayne movies or a lot of Westerns, they might think you like horses. So all of a sudden you start getting a bunch of equestrian suggestions. Yeah.
This is all exploding around us. So it seems to me to be quick, but it's not quick. It's 20 years.
It's the overnight sensation that took 20 years.
Yeah. I remember contacting you in 2010 because I wrote a book called The 151 Best Movies You've Never Seen.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, what a great tie-in with Netflix this would be, because they rent DVDs.
Yeah.
That's how they make their living, and I'm helping them recommend movies on DVD.
Right.
And then you broke the news to me that you were already in the future. So I didn't know this. You were already 10 years ahead of, 20 years ahead of me, because I'm always behind. But you already knew where Netflix was going.
Yeah.
And that hustling DVDs was not.
You had a phone call. Yeah. You had a phone call with him, as you were telling me before, because you have to fill in your blank. He said, "What do you think of this?"
Yeah.
And you went, "Well, actually, the DVD, that's not going to be so much of what we do."
Yeah.
And it is, I say this over and over again to people, I'm 33, that's not old. I'm not old by any means. But in terms of the technology shift, that's gone on in my lifetime, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah, it is pretty crazy.
Because my dad was at ET, I saw really early computers. I remember when it was a wall, you know, when you go to ET and it was like, here's the computer.
Right.
It lives here. You know, it was its own
entity. Its own zip code.
But that's it. You know, my dad had a pager. My dad was one of the first people I'd ever seen who had a pager because Entertainment Tonight got... I always loved that, the idea too of like, there's important entertainment news, Leonard. We need you to have a pager.
You know what I got to do when I was studying to be a journalist? I interned for the critic at the Arizona Republic.
Oh, wow.
Bud Wilkerson. I don't know if you ever knew that name, but... Phoenix was not a big market, so probably not. But the night of the finale of MASH is when I was interning with him, and we watched the episode. They didn't leak the episode early for critics, and we had to get in the car and literally race across town to the newsroom so he could file his review. And he had about an hour window from the time the show was over to her, and so he couldn't have done it online. Couldn't have opened a laptop and did that. And the idea then, it just like, it reminded me of like one of those old movies from the 30s when the verdict comes in.
Yes,
and the reporters
run out
to the payphones. So, but it's amazing how fast, like my kids are 23 and 25, and they have never not known cartoons on demand of some form.
Right.
So when I told them, I said, when I was a kid, if you overslept on Saturday morning, you had to wait till next week for cartoons.
Right.
That's right.
Right.
And they have never grown up where they didn't have Nickelodeon, where they didn't have 24-hour cartoons.
Yeah. But that's what I mean. It's so crazy. So I say, I'll say to someone, I know that I'm not old, but the idea that I remember when the cell phone became a thing.
Yeah.
You know, hell, when we got fancy calculators, that was a big deal. When those T9 Texas things popped up and you could suddenly make it do, you know, thing other than writing boobs on your computer, you know, you can suddenly make it do different stuff. It is mind blowing.
Yeah.
And when you look at Netflix, and again, even just thinking about how I watched it before, how I watch it now.
Yeah.
I'll see a movie that I love and I'll tell my dad, and I can also tell my friend in Europe, I can say, hey, you guys should check out this movie.
Well, that's a real interesting thing with this change is that people would always go to a cocktail party or a dinner party and talk about a show that they watched and you hadn't seen yet. And then you were just kind of stuck.
Yes.
Because you couldn't go back and start from the beginning.
Yeah.
And if you could find it at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without going to buy a DVD box set or whatever. So, but now you'd say you go home from the party and that thing you were just talking about is right there.
Yeah.
And you just go home and
extraordinary.
Similar with the films. Similar with the films that someone will tell you they like it and you can watch it.
Now. Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah.
That's a big one for us for film festivals.
For sure.
Is it used to be, it is funny. It changes things a little bit because when I'm at a festival, I don't feel the same impetus. Like if I don't see this, it's disappeared forever.
Right.
But it is really wild that there are movies where, again, even 15 years ago, I'd see it and I go, I hope you get to see it one day.
Yeah. Right.
It may not. Now we're with you at Telluride and we're going, well, here's Ted's babies. You know, here are all of these that are going to be there.
Two asterisk points.
Yeah.
You mentioned you dropped the name Lou Grant among TV shows.
Yes.
Tell us about meeting Ed Asner.
That was a super important meeting in my life because it was this interesting, it became like this really crossroads in my life, not just professionally, but also personally. Because so I'm this young high school writer, and Lou Grant was the head of the Screen Actors Guild. And he was coming, he came to town.
Lou Grant, the character.
I'm sorry, Lou Grant. Ed Asner. Ed Asner, the actor, was the head of the Screen Actors Guild for this window, this period of time.
I was just going with it. I was like, Lou Grant.
Yeah,
I'm with
go
you.
Along.
Go on, yeah.
And he was also the star of Lou Grant.
Right.
And what had happened in that window of time was that he became very outspoken about the war in Nicaragua. And Kimberly Clark got very upset that he was being politically active. And they pulled the sponsorship of Lou Grant. And it was a big... And it ultimately led to the cancellation of the show. And he didn't really talk about it in the press. And I was always kind of really fascinated with the story. And I was always kind of interested in politics and that weird, interesting crossover of politics and entertainment. So he came out to Phoenix to speak at a local chapter meeting. And I went out to this meeting. And it was the middle of the summer. It was really, I remember it because it was very, very hot. And he came in and I approached him and said, can I interview you for the newspaper? And he just said, what a nice kid, you know, I'll do the interview. But he said, I will, but you have to wait till after I'm running late and the meeting's getting ready to start and I'll come out after and we'll do it. I go, great. The meeting went for 6 hours. And I stayed around. I think I stayed around. I may have cheated. I might have left and came back. But I remember him coming out. He was so shocked that I was still around that he gave me the interview. He gave me the office number and we wound up doing a phone interview. And And actually I sold, it was the only, I think it was the first piece, bit of professional writing I ever sold, which was also not very good, but it was it was hard to get to him to do the interview. And I wound up selling it to a magazine. It was called The Entertainer, which was there was an industry at the beginning of cable of all these independent TV guides.
Yep.
And I wrote a couple pieces for them. That was the first one I sold. Mm-hmm. And he, but through that interview, Ed introduced me to Martin Sheen, which I went and did that interview. And through that, he introduced me to this incredible activist priest called Blaise Pontaine that just like got...
Blaise Pontaine.
That's a great name, isn't it?
That's a fantastic name.
And he wound up... So basically my politics got wrapped up in this, you know, kind of the place where politics and entertainment met, was super influenced at a pretty young age with those two meetings. Through that meeting, I also figured out a way to finagle my way into the 1983 Emmy Awards and meet a bunch of people as a young writer.
Cool.
And yeah, he was a very helpful man for me.
Good for you. And the other tiny asterisk is...
And Jillian. That's the other interview he connected for me. And Jillian was white hot at that moment.
Oh, yes,
too.
She was.
Yeah.
Yes, she was.
Yeah.
You still service DVD rentals, don't you?
We still do. There's a couple million people that still do it.
And that's what I find so fascinating. There's still a couple of million people.
Yeah. Huh.
To anyone else, that would be a business in itself.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be a very good business in itself. Yeah. I wish I had millions of subscribers or readers. Yeah. But so I find that interesting
too. I think it's some combination of you live in a place where the internet's slow.
Mm-hmm.
You're maybe at an age where you're not going to change your technology at
mm-hmm.
all. Or sometimes someone like you is like a huge movie buff, and just about everything published on DVD is still available through that service.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a one place where you can get all the new stuff and all the old stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the new streaming world, you know, it's very fragmented about which you can get where.
But I think it's significant that you haven't turned your back on those people.
Those
are not numbers. Those are people.
Those are people. Absolutely.
Yeah. You don't leave money on the table either.
That's true. That's true.
Point one of business.
That's true.
I never took business administration, but I think I got that part.
You would have got that. You would have got to that part. Yeah.
So how and when did you take that big bite and say, all right, we're going to become a source, a provider, a network, if you will? And what was the first, what were the first baby steps?
So it... if you go all the way back to 99 again,
mm-hmm.
Reed's statement that all filmed entertainment was going to come in on the internet,
mm-hmm.
then I kept asking myself and he and I would have these conversations. I'd say, well, if that's true, and I do believe it, but if we do believe it, then we have to believe that ABC is going to become ABC.com
mm-hmm.
and Disney's going to become an app on my television, and they're not going to want to sell us their stuff anymore. And if that comes, we better get good at making our own content, our own programming, and we better start now. There wasn't a magic moment, except for in a very kind of happenstance meeting. We met with this company called MRC, Media Rights Capital, about something completely unrelated. And on the way out the door, the guy says to me, this weekend we're going to be pitching a show called House of Cards to all these networks. And David Fincher is working on a film at Sony, so we're going to do it on a soundstage at Sony. Do you guys want to come hear the pitch? And I said, what is it? And he goes, oh, it's House. I go, this is the British House of Cards, which I knew the show very well from seeing it on DVD at Netflix. And he said, yeah. So we bought the rights to do it, and this guy Bo Willimon has written three amazing scripts, and he was nominated for an Oscar in that moment for Ides of March that mm-hmm. he wrote the screenplay for. Kevin Spacey was attached to star. That was a good thing then mm-hmm. at that day. Robin Wright was mm-hmm. attached to star, and David Fincher was going to direct his first television show.
Is that all?
That's all.
Just them.
So
cool.
I listened to that, and I knew the original storyline, and I said we went. You know, we thought about it for a little bit. And I gave him a call back, and I said, you know, I don't want to go hear the pitch. I'm saying yes right now. And I will come to you on Monday after the pitches and tell you why you should do it with us. And so they heard their pitches, and it was very competitive, AMC, HBO, everybody wanted the show. And we had never produced or released an original anything on Netflix. So there was no reason for them to take this perfect package of television mm-hmm. and sell it to us. So I figured since there's 100 reasons to say no to us, I got to give them a one big one to say yes. And I said, we will give you a 2-season order with no pilot and no notes.
That's huge.
Yeah, this time a direct-to-season order was pretty rare, you know, at this time. This is 2012. And there was so, and basically the no creative, which gave total creative freedom. And you know, I remember David even saying, well, I might want your feedback. Well, I bet you don't. And it was the offer you can't refuse. And at the time it was, you know, maybe it was ignorance is bliss, you know, so I didn't know that I was about to screw up the whole TV business that way.
Disruptor. Yeah. Ted the Disruptor.
But I just figured we had to do something to overcome all the negatives.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't have sold that show to us in that situation. And they said yes. And so basically I did tell to David, you know, David, in theory, he could have given us 26 hours of home movies for all that money.
Mm-hmm.
But I did say, but you do have to put your name on it. And I knew that David would not put his name on something he didn't support.
Naturally.
Yeah. So that was the beginning of it. And the timing of it was just that beautiful package that said now. And my analysis of it was that a straight risk reward, that if this show doesn't work, we will have terribly overpaid for one show, which we're always at risk of doing.
Right.
And if it does work, it could fundamentally change our business. And it just felt like a great trade-off.
Are you a gambler?
No.
I'm just curious.
I enjoy it, but I'm not a gambler.
Not a flippant question. Okay, all right.
Yeah, like I can walk through the casino and not
yeah,
stop.
Okay, all right, fine.
But
fine.
It felt to me like the most rational bet ever when you do it in that kind of risk reward.
Sure.
And so we said, like, you know, we said we're going to try it. This is the one. And we pulled the trigger on it. They, you know, it took about 18 months to get everything going, get the film, getting it delivered. And in the meantime, I got a call from an agent who represented Stevie Van Zandt. And he said, can you take a call with Stevie Van Zandt? He's very excited about what you're doing with House of Cards. And I go, Stevie Van Zandt, of course. I'm a massive Bruce Springsteen fan. So I get on the phone with Stevie, and he starts telling me about this show that he's in Norway making right now. And I said, it's called Lilyhammer. And he's like, I'm in Norway. I'm producing a garage band in Norway. And I met these two writers who are making this great show about a mobster who's in the witness relocation program who picks Lilyhammer, Norway, because he saw it on the Olympics and thought it looked cool. And it's a fish-out-of-water comedy. And you'd love it, and we're trying to, it's meant to be just a Norwegian show, but we're trying to raise some money so I could put better music on the show. And would you take a look at it? And I go, yeah, of course, would you send a script over? He goes, no, I'll send the episodes over. We're almost done with it.
Hmm.
So it was again, like a kind of a no-brainer, which I'm watching, you know, him play basically the same character he played on The Sopranos, looked like him, sounds like him, talks like him, you know, whatever happened to him. And one theory was that he got into witness relocation and he went to Norway and here it is.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a cool relationship with HBO and David Chase that he created that character. So they let him take it off. They let him take it away.
Mm-hmm. And David Chase being the creator of Sopranos.
The creator of Sopranos, right. So we did the show with Stevie that actually became our first launched original show because
mm-hmm.
we wanted to figure out some things. So we figured out on the smaller show first. And it was a great hit for a couple of years for us. We really loved it. And still do. I still love those episodes. But then, when it came time to like say, how are we going to release it? Which seemed like a strange question, but I hadn't thought about everything on Netflix was all at once. You know what I mean? Because we always got it a year after television, so we just put it all up.
Right.
Yeah.
Now we have something that's going to originate. How are you going to release it? And we looked at from what we saw. Was that when someone's watching a show on Netflix, even going back to the DVD days, sometimes you'd watch 2, sometimes you watch 3, some nights you're really into it, you watch 4, but you never watch 1. So
it's true.
So we just said, look, I don't want to pick and pick wrong. Let's just put them all up like everything else. It wasn't like there wasn't a binge strategy. Mm-hmm. It was just like, that's how we'll put it up and see what happens. And sure enough, binging was actually going on all the time. We just kind of named it or packaged it.
Mm-hmm.
But the people were binging.
Isn't that crazy to think about? You know, you're talking about working at a video store and running a video store in Arizona. And then we're here.
Yeah.
And something like binging, you and your company named it that. and it's become a thing.
You know, it's funny. We didn't name it.
I don't, but
you know, it's a funny thing because we really resisted the name.
Yeah?
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal wrote a piece and kind of they coined the phrase binging on us. And we were in a panic. Because I remember thinking, binge, that sounds so negative. Like, after binge comes purge.
Right, we don't want purge.
But we couldn't convince them not to use the word. And they came out with binge, and it stuck. And it turns out to be such a great it turned into a positive.
Yes, it is. It is. And again, an impact on the culture.
But that's the stuff that blows my mind is that we can look at people and say, okay, it's you read and, you know, you Ted, and here's how this stuff happened. Yeah. That is just crazy.
It's pretty crazy.
You know?
It's, you know the other thing that I hope when you think back on all of this, it'd be a bit of history of in a way, that the other thing I'm really proud about House of Cards is not that it was just the way it was released and all those things, because there's a ton of firsts in there. It was the first show to win a primetime Emmy to never have aired on primetime television. But it was the interesting thing I thought was it's the first show that was actually written and produced to be watched like this. You know, because everything else on television, you know, we put it on after, you know, you pull the commercials out and you put it on TV. But even a show for HBO, it was meant to be watched once a week. And what we knew was, you know, in linear television, if you're watching a show, there's about a 30-40% chance you didn't see the last week's episode. So they're constantly reminding you in the narrative. What happened last week. Yeah, we recap. Sometimes super casually, sometimes really on the nose. But what happens over the course of a season is probably 15 to 20% of the storytelling is reminding you what just happened. So if you knew people saw the last episode, you wouldn't do any of that, which gives you, over the course of a season, a couple of hours of extra character development, sidebar stories, character stories, all these things that you can do. That and the other thing was that by doing the two-season pickup, which was an act of desperation at the time, actually told the writers when they were writing episode one
that there was
going to be a 26, no matter what.
Yeah.
So they're not writing for their life. They're not trying to trick the audience into coming back every week. They're not trying to write two act breaks. You know what I mean?
Gee whiz. Now, last year you hit a peak with
another milestone
with Roma.
Yeah,
yet another milestone.
And black and white. On top of everything else, black and white.
Black and white,
which
Spanish,
brings
no stars.
Us joy. But that's another one where we're in Telluride. I'm on one of the shuttles with Albert Tello, and I say to him like I always do. That's a publicist friend, and I say to him, what are your babies this year? That's what I always refer to the movies as babies. I said, what are your babies this year? And he goes, you know, I have this movie, Roma, and I'm so proud of it. And he says to me, it's black and white, it's Spanish, and there are no name stars. And I said, I cannot wait to see what happens. And in Everybody Goes to Roma and Telluride, and of course they're knocked out. And it's because the talent, the way it's written, Alfonso, you know, all the pieces.
Yeah.
But then to watch it, and that's part of the craziness of seeing things at certain festivals especially, is that you do get to see the trajectory.
Right.
I get to watch it go from no one knows what this is to it's Oscar time and there everybody is sitting in that room. You know, it's a crazy thing to be around.
That Telluride screening was really emotional. I mean, hearing people around me sniffling and crying, which was really a moving experience.
Well, this year you have three, you have a lot of product, obviously.
Yeah, many more, but
many TV series, many movies, but you have The Irishman, which is a headline-making thing to have done also, to engage Martin Scorsese, arguably the finest filmmaker of our era. And then
all the actors, all of them.
All those actors and Stephen Zalian, great screenwriter. And you have The Two Popes, which a lot of people haven't seen yet but ought to.
Yeah.
With two of the finest actors on the planet, Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce. And another great
Fernando Morales.
And a great screenwriter again, Anthony McCarten. And then on top of that.
Marriage Story.
Which just absolutely put me away when I saw the Telluride.
But I'll say three of the best reviewed films that you've written about this year.
Yeah.
Because I'm the one who, I post his reviews. Each one of those had more adjectives, you know, for
superlatives.
Just, that's it. It's just.
So, you know, there's some element of luck, of course. You bankroll films and you bankroll TV shows and you hope they're going to turn out well.
Yeah.
And but there's no guarantee.
No, no guarantees.
And but you.
The main, I think there's a business philosophy that has always worked well for me in business that I've applied to the creative part of the job as well, which is if you pick the right people and you have the right strategy, you're okay. You're going to be okay. But picking the right people really matters. And then what you could, what you should do then is give those people all the tools they need to do the best work of their lives. And that will pay off. And if you, I think what happens is people get so nervous about a big bet that they try to overmanage the people who are executing the bet for them. And really, the, it's like hiring someone to do a job and then you get telling them how to do the job. And back to that David Fincher meeting, which I don't think you want my feedback. I'm not giving David Fincher notes. I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
And I think, like, you know, I take a lot of comfort that Martin Scorsese is directing a Steve Zaillian script with Al Pacino and Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci and Al Pacino
else.
For the very first time.
Yes.
I mean, this is an epic thing to happen.
Yeah.
And Harvey Keitel and the script was incredible. Mm-hmm. So I feel like if we did the picking right, what do you need to make this great?
Another of the most entertaining films of this year is Dolomite Is My Name.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when Scott and Larry came to my class with it, one of my students, who's a little more business savvy than some of the others, said, so what was it like working with Netflix as opposed to one of the conventional Hollywood studios? Scott said, well, they didn't break our hearts.
As compliments go, though, that's a big deal. You know?
Yeah, and they're eternally grateful to you
for
not only making the movie happen, which Eddie Murphy had wanted to do for so long, which they'd wanted to do for so long, but then you let them do it.
Yeah.
And that's your philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But they and by the way, and they delivered the movie they pitched.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which is also not always the case.
Yes.
But they really delivered exactly what they said they were going to. And it was that, for me, I remember it was that lightning bolt of seeing Eddie as Rudy Ray Moore in the room.
I can't imagine. Honestly, I can't imagine.
Yeah.
I cannot imagine sitting in your office going,
sure.
And then there was that moment where Eddie's on set playing Rudy on stage, and while in between takes, he just starts riffing with the audience full of extras, and everyone was on the floor like they were at an Eddie Murphy concert. I mean, you could see it in his eyes that he was just like, "Oh, I missed this."
Man, oh man.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible.
What an experience!
Yeah. But this, like you said, the timing that these movies all kind of come together.
Mm-hmm.
They were all over a pretty varied period of time. Two Popes was a pitch, you know, more than it was anything. At that point, it wasn't a script, and I think. Like Dolomite, Martin Scorsese tried for 13 years to get The Irishman made. And remember, the technology to finish The Irishman didn't really exist when we greenlit the film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the bet was that it would catch up, you know, in the course of the time it would take to make the movie. But more than that was like, well, if we don't get this movie made pretty soon, you know, we were worried that it never would get made, you know, the way that these guys have been trying to make it. And so we, you know, it was a leap of faith that Martin Scorsese was going to make a great mob movie. That's not that hard of a bet,
right?
You know what I mean? With a great script,
with those guys,
and the biggest
script.
And then just the notion that he had never directed Al Pacino before, I couldn't even imagine how that was possible.
Yeah.
And I had but as a film geek, what an experience I've had with the sitting in the room sometimes with these guys with them, and I have. Al Pacino telling the stories about Dog Day Afternoon, that is just like just those stories were worth the cost of entry.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a crazy. At one point, remember sitting in Marty's trailer on set.
Marty.
It sounds all pretentious.
No, not at all. Yeah. It's just one of those things.
He is Marty.
Well,
after a while, he totally is Marty. but it was he. And Robert De Niro and Al Pacino and Leonardo DiCaprio was visiting the set that day.
Of course he was. Of course he was.
And we sat there and listened to De Niro and Pacino swap stories. Mm-hmm. And at one point, Al Pacino tells a story about a mob hit that happened in Columbus Square or Columbus Circle in New York while they were working on The Godfather. Hmm. And then I had that it just hit me out of the blue. Oh yeah, you're Michael Corleone. I'm sitting in this trailer with Michael Corleone. So,
well, that's so cool. It sounds exciting.
It sounds like it's really cool to be you.
You know what? I'm not kidding you. I'm as fortunate as they come. I mean, some people talk about how they get to live their dream, you know, do their dream jobs and all. This is 100% a dream come true. I feel like the people I get to work with is like, I'm walking among gods, you know? And I do feel like I have such going all the way back to that kid in the chaotic house, taking such, the people that are in that, that were in that, I wanted to be with those people in that box.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You are.
And I never even thought in my wildest dreams at that time I'd be in any way responsible for those people in that box.
Sure.
I wouldn't have, I just would have liked to see him every once in a while. I would have been happy getting a selfie with Martin Scorsese back then, you know, 2 years ago. Yes.
Now, there's another film that I ought to mention in all fairness, because I got an award screener. No.
Oh, Laundromat?
No.
Oh. We can play it. You have a lot on your network, man.
Keep going.
Nicole's movie.
Oh, The Black Godfather.
Yep.
Yeah.
What an interesting movie. Your wife, Nicole, is the daughter of a remarkable man.
Yes.
A remarkable man named Clarence Avon.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know about him until
Most
I saw this
not.
Film. Yeah. And it's an amazing life. What an amazing story.
Yeah. I mean, that's an incredible life. And the fact that he's with us and I can draw on him for for business advice at a time. And he's a remarkable guy who figured out early on that he had some power in this world and decided to use it to advance the causes of black people across entertainment, sports, film, music, and so much. He really changed the way you taught what you so kindly said about people who change things. I mean, Clarence has been, was an agent of change for years and years and years, and really an unsung hero.
Mm-hmm.
And so my wife had that, always wanted to make this film. She always wanted to tell his story. She wasn't ever sure if it was a film or a book or whatever. Mm-hmm. But
how did she pitch the film to you?
Well, it's a fair question.
No, I always knew
that this
picture.
Was a story that someone should make.
Sure.
And I had always had through over the years different people saying someone should make a documentary about Clarence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Netflix has been like the center of great documentary films for years and years and years, even back to the DVD days. And I couldn't stand the thought that documentary would be anywhere else. Even though there was is there a conflict of interest? Yes, there's a conflict of interest. But the bigger conflict would be that movie ends up on HBO and I have to have Thanksgiving dinner with these people. But I knew too that my wife's an amazing producer, even though she'd not produced a film before, because she produces everything.
Yeah.
She produces, she's constantly producing.
Oh, and my mom wants to be her best friend, two of them.
She's phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, she saw Barack Obama coming before everyone else coming. Mm-hmm. So she, she's got an incredible, incredible eye for talent in that way. I mean, all the things that you want in a good producer. And the film came out so strong and so powerful. And it was like one of those things where it could have been just a love letter to her dad.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And it's a really important piece of American history and black history and music history. And I'm just so proud of her and proud of it. The movie got named by the National Board of Review as one of the top five documentaries of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the kind of in the 11th hour of the production, we screened it for Pharrell Williams, who was so moved by the movie that he offered to do an original song for the film. I shouldn't say offered. Nicole said, you're making an original song for us. And he sure enough turned that film.
Thank you for your candor.
Exactly. And he made this incredible song, Letter to My Godfather, that was, that's so incredible. I've been getting to see him perform the song. And,
wow.
So anyway, it's a really great film and a real accomplishment of Reggie Hudlin, the director, and Nicole, who produced it.
And with testimony on camera from two U.S. presidents.
Two U.S. presidents, yeah.
Pretty amazing.
And Hank Aaron. And
oh, yeah, the list. If we start listing.
Bill Withers.
We'll be here.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, no, it's unbelievable that it's almost like, but people had pitched it as different things before, like the Forrest Gump of
yeah.
It was the bridge to everywhere. He was like kind of the bridge to everywhere.
Yeah, And if you haven't seen it, folks, it's well worth seeing.
Yeah, see The Black Godfather now on Netflix.
I bet you can find it on Netflix. One last business question, because I don't want people to say, "Well, you're sitting there, Ted Sarandos. You just ask him cream puff questions." All right. So here's the tough one. Here's the tough question. Are you worried? Are you worried
just
about
in
the
life, just about things,
about,
no.
about all the upcoming competition? You really have had a playground for a long time as Netflix, being a pioneer, being the first one up that hill.
Yeah.
To make this happen, to get people interested in streaming, to get people to subscribe, to get people to binge. And you've been right there leading the charge. But now you're going to have some pretty heavy-duty competition. Disney, Warner, all those other folks.
So we've been competing with all those folks from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we've been competing with pretty much the same, essentially the same programming,
mm-hmm.
but on their legacy platforms.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're going to compete on our platform, which is a good, that's okay. To me, I feel like competition's great. Mm-hmm. It's great for consumers because it makes everybody, work harder. It pushes everybody creatively.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about the kind of in the earlier days when HBO was the only person making great TV, only company making great TV,
yeah.
and then AMC got into the game and pushed them and they pushed each other. And then we got into the game and pushed it again. And I think there's this great cycle of constant improvement that comes from competition. So I'm very excited about that. And as a company, we've never really spent much time talking about the competitors. And I've always encouraged people not to. And I said, focus on the customer, focus on the viewer, because we have a couple of things that go on Netflix that make us very unique. One is you said it's so easy just to push play and find something great. You can also push one key and cancel us.
Mm-hmm.
So we are constantly being evaluated by our members and they're saying, am I getting joy for my money on Netflix? If not, they would cancel. So we focus on creating great, holy cow, entertainment moments for our subscribers that makes them not second guess, their membership money every month.
Mm.
So that hasn't changed. So what I have to do today is exactly what we've been doing for 20 years, which is we have to deliver your favorite movie or TV show seamlessly. And that has not changed as new competitors come in.
And you look calm.
Yeah.
You don't look bothered.
I am one of those people, no joke, I have Netflix on every single day.
Yeah.
Because I put it on when I'm going to go to sleep. If I want to put on Great British Bake Off, just something to relax me. I'm in the middle of watching The Staircase. I'm a documentary nut.
Amazing with Staircase.
I watch every documentary, Tell Me Who I Am, you name it. I watch every doc. And so for me, it's a joy.
Yeah.
It really is. It's a joy. And I love finding stuff. And I think that's what my fellow movie nerds are excited about, is that we just keep getting to see so much from so many people, big names, huge names, and then young people and indie folks never had a platform like this
and
before.
And remember, it's not the people, because we do produce a lot of programming, and people mm-hmm. are always like, are you afraid you're going to run out of storytellers, you're going to run out of ideas? Well, if you think all the great ideas come from Los Angeles, California, yes. But we have found creative showrunners and writers all over the world.
Oh, yeah.
Making amazing. We have this girl, Lori Nunn, who runs a show called Sex Education. She's from the UK. She's in her 20s. She's an international television showrunner now. There's a group of writers, a collective of writers, who created a show on Netflix in Italy called Baby. The youngest one was 17 or 18 years old when they started doing the show. They would be YouTube creators. They are international television showrunners now. And on the film side, this is, again, this kind of nice being around the ecosystem. We're making Spike Lee's next movie right now. And Spike is a professor at NYU. He has a student named Stefan Bristol, who made an incredible thesis film called See You Yesterday. And he said, Ted, I'm telling you, this student has got something I've not seen before. He has his student film was amazing, and he has a take on how to adapt it into a feature. It needs this much money. I'll keep an eye on it. Will you give him a shot? Absolutely. Let's do it. And he made this great movie called See You Yesterday that has been seen by millions of people all over the world.
I've seen it.
And just got nominated for 2 Independent Spirit Awards.
Yep.
And we're so proud of him. And it's just like these opportunities didn't come around when you had, one way to get your film out or
exactly.
one way to get your TV show on television. Right. And there were 3 networks and 3 hours of prime time.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the best time in the history of entertainment to be a creator.
Dairy Girls. You know, I said to my dad, you have to watch, you're going to laugh. You have to watch this show. My mom and my dad watch it and they crack up.
So funny.
It's so damn funny.
Yeah.
End of the effing world.
Yeah.
Brilliant show. I just binged season two. You know, I just did the
binging. I thought it would be hard to top season one. Season two is pretty great.
Same. Yeah. It's so good. But that's it. There's, as I say, it's. I'm excited.
Excellent.
It makes me excited.
And that's what that, by the way, that is what we have to do every day.
Yeah.
That's a pretty nice way to get out of bed in the morning. Yeah.
Well, it's very kind of you to carve out an hour of your busy, busy life
thrilled.
To talk to us.
And I enjoy when we all run into each other. Mm-hmm. I'm as thrilled to see you as anyone. And so it's really great to finally do this. We talked about this for quite a while, so I'm glad we got to do it finally.
It's like you're busy or something. You know.
Continued
we didn't
success.
Even talk about our cool thing we got to see Defending Your Life.
Oh gosh, I don't know. We maybe should keep that private.
Okay.
Just I wouldn't want to.
Okay.
I wouldn't want to rustle any feathers.
I'm a monster Albert Brooks fan. And,
me too.
Yeah, and so that was we had a nice experience where we got to see it in a small setting, and it turns out to be her favorite movie of all time. Was Defending Your Life.
Wow. Really?
And one of mine is Lost in America, but my wife's favorite is Defending
Your Nest Egg Concept.
The nest. You can't say the word nest or egg. Birds live in round sticks.
Thanks once again, Ted.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Great to have you here. And where do people find us when we're not doing this, Jesse?
You are at Leonard Maltin. I'm at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. And you can go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff.
And you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/MaltinOnMovies. patreon.com/MaltinOnMovies. Thanks for your support and thanks for listening. Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.